In this next hour, we hear about the plot to defund public sector unions regarding the case of Janus versus AFSCME, the Supreme Court case that was just decided on June 27, 2018. The Supreme Court justices handed down a 5-4 decision, which dealt a major blow to organized labor. The ruling means that public sector unions across the nation could lose tens of millions of dollars and see their effectiveness diminished. We asked a panel of experts on labor and union law to explore the history of weakening public sector unions and discuss how the Janus versus AFSCME case will affect the future of labor unions. Also on the day that the case was decided, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, a staunch advocate of the First Amendment, announced his retirement after serving over 30 years on the court. We hear from three panelists. Cortland Roser Jones, a Williams Hasty Fellow at UW Law School, Mary Batari, Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and Kevin Gunlach, President of the South Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. The talk took place on June 13, 2018, at the Madison Central Library and was sponsored by the Madison Institute and co-sponsored by the Center for Media and Democracy, South Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, and the American Constitution Society. But first we hear from Fred Wade, president of the Madison Institute, who introduces the speakers.
The genesis of this program was an article by Mary Batari. She is the deputy director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and I happened to see an article in These Times that she had written about this case and the background of how it came to be before the court. And I thought that was interesting and would make a good topic for discussion. And then I found we were very fortunate to have Cortland Roser Jones, who is a fellow at UW Law School and had written an article about the very subject. So she is joining us this evening as well. Her article appeared in the Northwestern Law Review, and she will be going on to teach at the Ohio State Law School this fall. We also have Kevin Gunlach, the president of the South Central Federation of Labor, who comes out of the AFSCME, which is the defendant in the case. So I think we've got a very knowledgeable panel, and the presentation should address the issue in good terms. So with that, we will begin. I'll ask the speakers to come to the podium. We'll start with Cortland Roser Jones.
As Fred had mentioned, my name is Cortland Roser Jones. I am a research fellow over at Wisconsin right now, but I'm transitioning, so I get two apartments. I get one in Madison and one in Columbus because I am joining the faculty at Ohio State this fall. And I've done some research on the legal issues that are being played with in Janus right now. And with that research, I was fortunate enough to actually go to the oral argument back in February. So I'm happy to talk about that a little later. But what I am tasked with right now is to give you an overview of the legal issues that's being considered in this case and how we got here. So I get the privilege of trying to tell you why the biggest union case in 20, 30 years is being decided under the First Amendment, why this is a free speech case. So I will do my best. What the issue that Janus is deciding is whether an Illinois law allowing public sector unions to charge non-members, represented non-members, collective bargaining and contract-related fees for their services violates the First Amendment. That's the long one. The short one is whether we're going to overturn a 40-year-old precedent called Abood v. Detroit, a Board of Education. And it is a 40-year-old precedent. When I say precedent, I just mean that it is a 40-year-old law. You know, this is 40-year-old holding that we're looking at. Now, the Illinois law that's being challenged has to do with something you might hear me refer to as agency fees, or sometimes I call them fair share fees. Fair share and agency fees refers to this cost that these laws, and plenty of states have them, that allow unions to charge these non-members who are represented a prorated cost of a full union dues that would represent their collective bargaining, contract-related expenses, but not their political you know, any of the union's political activities. So that's why it's prorated. We're going to pay for the contract-related stuff, not the political activities, and that is the agency or fair share fee. This agency or fair share fee arises out of the union's origin of the duty of fair representation, right, which we know, or maybe you know, that all employees who are benefiting from a union's collective bargaining, you know, grievance representation, any contract-related services, if you are a represented union, so you've got your majority, you were voted in by majority, then that union has to represent all employees that are within that bargaining unit, whether or not you decide to actually join a union. So presumably you're still benefiting from the union's contract-related, you know, grievance representation. Any of those kinds of activities you're still benefiting from if you're not joining the union. So that is where this fair share fee comes from. So you're going to pay your fair share for that kind of representation, but you don't have to pay for any kind of political activities. So now this legal doctrine for agency fees that says that this prorated cost is constitutional comes from a case in 1977 that I mentioned called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education. And it comes up with this compromise, Abood does, that is that non-members can be forced to pay for some union activities, the collective bargaining, these are in the statute, but can't be forced to pay for any political activities. And it's the same constitution that the court reaches in the private sector about 20 years before, but this one is a constitutional distinction because we're looking at, you know, we know that unions are engaged in what we think of as more traditional political activities. They lobby, right? They do give political donations. So we're saying those are protected under the First Amendment, right? Unions are associations that are allowed to be engaged in First Amendment activity. And the court is saying that if you are forced to subsidize that union or that union, there is a First Amendment issue involved, interest involved here. Now, we're not sure if it's going to violate the First Amendment, but there's a First Amendment interest in being forced to subsidize a political association or an association that's engaged in some kind of political speech. So Abood dealt with this very similar challenge in Janus. And it comes down with this compromise. It's a very practical compromise, I think. And what it says is, okay, we're going to recognize this First Amendment interest, that you have a First Amendment interest in not being forced to subsidize a union. But we're going to balance this against the state's interest, too. We're going to recognize that there are some other interests that are in play. We've got state's interest in efficiency. We want to prevent free riding. We want labor peace. So we're looking at these over on the other side, and we're going to say that is going to outweigh your First Amendment interest in maybe your First Amendment interest in playing for contract or, you know, contract-related activities. Now, political activities, this is how we get the compromise. We are going to go ahead and say that is a stronger First Amendment interest. It's directly related to, right, here, this strong First Amendment origin in political speech. So we're not going to let the compromise, you know, force agency fee payers to pay for that prorated amount. So this is the compromise that's been around for 40 years is where we're at. So Justice Potter Stewart writes this, right? This is in 1977. And then we see Justice Alito coming along about 4 or 5 years ago, and he starts to really question, very out loud, he starts to really question this holding in Abood. And he's arguing in Harris v. Quinn a couple years ago, in dicta, which is another law school word, we say this as it's not law, but I'm thinking out loud, you know, and a lot of times you'll hear dicta as kind of a signal, like where this law should go in the future. So Justice Alito comes up with this idea that's not new, but it, for the first time, starts to get a majority of the court. Right, and this idea is that, okay, if you believe, you know, I'll go with the distinction Abood draws, I'll adopt it for the private sector, at least for now. But there's something going on in the public sector, at least, that makes all agency fees inherently political, because you can't look at what a public sector union does, even when they're bargaining over something, you know, very, what we think of as being like a quintessential employment term like wages, right? We can't look at that and say that it's not at least a little bit political in the broadest sense because of the economic effects that it's gonna have on the government budget, right? So if you're gonna draw political, or you're gonna define it as that broad, then every single thing a public sector union does is going to be a little bit, right? We're gonna be inherently political. And then if you step back and you look at this balancing that Abood did, and if we put political costs on one side and said the First Amendment is, you know, violated, and then collective bargaining over here. Well, now all of a sudden everything is got to come down on the First Amendment side. So this is the argument that the challengers and Janus are using. It's that everything to do with public sector employment is going to be political. Therefore, dissenting public employees shouldn't have to pay for union services, because the impact of what that union's going to do is an important public policy issue. I'll leave it there, because I think it tees it up. I think just a little bit of the arguments that are being made, that is still the crux of the argument that is on the challenger side. What I saw in the unions is when the argument that we've seen for the last 40 years, which is that this is a compromise, right? Compromises aren't perfect, but this has worked. This is functional. You'll also see an argument that's, it's interesting, I didn't actually see this one as much. This is the same issue that the court heard in Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association, if you remember hearing about that 2 years ago. In that case, it was decided 4-4 because we heard the argument. We were expecting a big decision, and then we lost Justice Alito, so this is one of the per curiam opinions, one of the very few that the court could not come to a decision on. So now we've got it again 2 years later. So what's interesting in this time, in this court, is you will hear, I think, us as panelists be a little bit like, ho-hum, like this is not going to, you know, we have an idea of what the decision's going to be, and a lot of unions have been preparing for this. The court this time really backed off from this idea that it's a great compromise, or it's a compromise, and we're gonna deal with a compromise. And now we're really playing with this idea of stare decisis, which is, it's 40 years old, right? It's worked for 40 years. There are a lot of things in the law that sometimes aren't perfect, but we're going to keep it the way it is because we have all this reliance interest, right? We have contracts in 23 states that have dealt with this holding for 40 years. So now we're dealing with this issue of, well, should we just leave it? You know, which I think is very different than 2 years ago when we were still arguing for this as a good First Amendment compromise. So those are the two sides of the legal argument. I'm happy to talk more specifics about what, you know, specific justices said during the argument or who will write or what I think. But I'm going to pause there so that you can hear from Mary, because I think she's going to give you a lot of really wonderful background as to how we got to the Supreme Court to begin with.
You're listening to a panel discussion on the plot to defund public sector unions regarding the case of Janus versus AFSCME. The Supreme Court handed down its decision 5-4 on June 27, 2018. The decision dealt a major blow to organized labor. The three panelists are Cortland Roser-Jones with the UW Law School, Mary Batari, Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and Kevin Gunlag, President of the South Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO.
So I'm Mary Batari. I work for the Center for Media and Democracy. And before I was involved as a consumer advocate for a lot of years, and then as a political aide for some years, and now as a reporter for many years, I wanted to be an archaeologist. And so when this case came down and everybody was going, is it Janus? Is it Janus? Is it this? Is it that? What a strange name. I said, oh my God, it's Janus, the Roman god with two faces. And my staff looked at me like, okay. So, but anyways, to me, it was like the perfect name, because out there in the public, if you're reading the SCOTUS blog or you're reading Time magazine or you're looking at mainstream media, you see this really nice guy named Mark Janus. And he's a child support worker in the state of Illinois. He's an AFSCME 31 council member. And 31 council non-dues paying, represented by AFSCME, paying agency fees kind of person. And he's a Boy Scout, and he talks about, you know, being a Boy Scout in the media, and he's a child support worker, very sympathetic character. And this gentleman now has his case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Isn't this amazing? And then you pull back the curtain just a tiny bit, and you see that the guy didn't even actually have a lawsuit in the first place. This case was brought by Bruce Rauner, the governor of Illinois, the venture capitalist billionaire governor of Illinois, who pledged to go after unions on the campaign trail, and then did. And because he issued an executive order saying that the unions couldn't collect their dues using their normal process that they had been doing. And this ended up in court, and the court found that he didn't have standing to proceed. And so, lickety-split, the lawyers brought in a new plaintiff who didn't have an original action before the courts, and that was Mark Janus, who makes for a much more sympathetic plaintiff than a billionaire venture capitalist who has declared his war on unions. So this case has two phases. I started looking at the amicus briefs for this case, and if you had the drudgery, as I'm sure the professor has, of having to read all these amicus briefs, they all sound the same. They are legal arguments, thorough legal arguments, and premised on the fact that the writers are in favor of workers, that they're in favor of workers' rights and First Amendment rights. They're against forced unionization, a term that most people aren't familiar with. they're for workers' choice and all these, you know, just fabulous terms. Well, at the Center for Media and Democracy, what we do day in and day out is we track the right wing. And we track their Twitter feeds, and we track their Facebooks, and we track their publications, and often we get leaked documents. And when big document stashes are released, we go through them. And so earlier that year, we had found a State Policy Network toolkit and the State Policy Network, if you don't know it, is a group of 66 state-based think tanks. And it's sort of a sister group to ALEC. And we know who the two State Policy Network think tanks are in Wisconsin, do we? Anyone? Bradley Foundation is a foundation. That's a little bit different. But the two think tanks are the McIver Institute and WPRI, which has changed its name to the Badger Institute just recently. And they are part of a national network of right-wing think tanks called the State Policy Network. And the State Policy Network, had a secret union-busting toolkit. And we got that published in The Guardian magazine on Labor Day of last year. And the way that the secret union-busting toolkit talks about this case and this set of issues is not the way it sounds in the amicus briefs. And part of the reason we did this big article for In These Times, so it was a cover story for In These Times, the month of the case, is because, gee, when you look at all those amici, they look like they're from all over the United States. There's a Michigan think tank, and there's a Ohio think tank, and there's all these James Madison Institute from Florida, and all these institutions and people really think this is an important case, and they're all members of the State Policy Network, and they're all funded by the same group of people. And this has been a many decades long plotted and planned series of cases and strategies and tactics that we have suffered ourselves here in Wisconsin. So in the article, we like to talk about a troika of institutions because a Harvard professor, Thaddeus Scotchbowl, coined this term. And one institution we're familiar with here in Wisconsin, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council. Because in 2011, our institution published 800 ALEC model bills for the first time ever. They had been kept secret. They're now, ALEC now puts them up on their web pages, but these bills have been kept secret. We published them. And so when they're popping up all over the country, people can now see that these were ALEC bills that are written behind closed doors with corporate lobbyists and politicians, and then secretly introduced in states, sort of stripped of their ALEC origins. So people don't know that these corporations and these politicians had already voted on these bills at an ALEC meeting earlier in the year. So ALEC is a big part of the union-busting machine. It had a stack of union-busting bills, yay high. And here in Wisconsin, Act 10 borrowed from this ALEC library of bills. right to work here in Wisconsin, the private sector unions, was a verbatim ALEC bill. There are so few people for right to work in Wisconsin that they had to fly in their roving band of ALEC scholars and Heritage Foundation experts that were underwritten by the Koch brothers and the whole Koch money operation. And that's one strategy. Where they could introduce and pass bills in red states, they did. And we saw that here in Wisconsin. And even though 400 construction firms, real people, real Democrats and Republicans, real businesses were against right to work, it was forced down our throats. And then came prevailing wage, another ALEC model bill, attack on the building trades and other trades. So we've seen this line of attack. There's another line of attack in blue states. In blue states, you can't do that. You don't have the governor. You don't have the legislature. You can't do that. So what do? Well, groups like the National Right to Work Foundation, which was founded in 1969, which has dedicated itself to abolishing what they call coercive union power, started looking for plaintiffs. So these aren't suits where a plaintiff is like, oh my goodness, my union is really oppressing me. These are suits where they're actively out there seeking plaintiffs to bring lawsuits to chip away at union rights and union power. And so I read all those amicus briefs, but at the same time those amicus briefs were being written, Tracy Sharp from the State Policy Network sent out a fundraising letter that was secret until we found it that said, I'm writing with you today to share with you our bold plan to permanently break the power of unions this year. I'm talking about the kind of dramatic reforms we've seen in recent years in Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, and now in West Virginia, freeing teachers and other government workers from coercive unionism. And she wants to do this, if you read on and read on, which I won't bore you with, to deal a major blow to the left's ability to control government and basically to elect Republicans. So the letter doesn't say it per se, but that's what this is all about. And we know that public sector unions and private sector unions, most of them, are often big supporters of the Democratic Party. We know that they provide the boots on the ground for the Democratic Party. And this is all an electoral strategy that's being pursued by think tanks and legal groups that are often charitable organizations. Let me tell you, kneecapping your political opponents is not a charitable activity, okay? You know, the Red Cross is a charitable activity. The Boys and Girls Club is a charitable activity. You know, killing off public sector unions just does not count. And so we tried to get this type of language, which you see in these documents, which you see in Bradley Foundation documents that were hacked and released last year, really pulls back the curtain on what their agenda is. And so in the red states, you go after them with bills. In the blue states, you go after them with lawsuits. And that's the origin of the Janus suit. It was brought by Rebecca Friedrichs, who was the perkiest, nicest plaintiff they could find in the state of California. She was a teacher in the state of California, and she was coached to bring this suit, to do all the PR interviews, and to be a fabulous plaintiff who appeared at a rally on the steps of the Supreme Court that was organized by the State Policy Network back when Friedrichs was introduced. Well, that entire rally was repeated with the same people and the same group sponsoring it for the Janus case. And the sign said, instead of saying, stand with Rebecca, they now said, stand with Mark. And when you look at who's in the audience, it's a riot. It's not, you think it was going to be everyday teachers or child support workers or whatever, but knowing the crowd, I could spot Grover Norquist, I could spot Grover Norquist's assistant, I could spot the AFP guy who's one of their research analysts, you know, and we sent someone to start interviewing these people and asking them why they were there, and they all like declined interviews. And so it's a total put-up operation. That sort of rally on the steps was a complete put-up. And this year, when the rally occurred, I believe the teachers' unions had two giant posters blown up, one of Charles Koch and one of David Koch, who were then present on the Capitol steps, on the Supreme Court steps at the time of this argument. So I'll stop there and encourage you to take a look at this very long and detailed article, which also details all the money behind this and all the other foundations pursuing this type of sort of extreme form of libertarianism that believes that the role of government and should be as minimalist as possible. And one of my favorite quotes from the article was, again, from Theda Skocpol, the Harvard sociologist. And she said, really, she says, when you look at this, they're trying to clear the field of any other form of organized power. They're trying to just, you know, they want it for themselves. They want the arena for themselves. And she also said, this is about teachers. She said, teachers are, in every community in the United States, they're organized, they're articulate, they do not like the privatization of American schools, they believe that government works and should be working for people, and this is about getting at teachers. And so this is one of the most depressing articles I have ever written, because I am not at all hopeful about what's going to happen here. We just had this atrocious case as U.S. Supreme Court that originated from EPIC, our own corporation here, which is supposed to be run by a liberal, which is supposed to be a liberal organization. It was an astonishing ruling that wage theft and other issues like that, and also perhaps sexual harassment and civil rights issues, will now have to go to arbitration, and that there can't be class action suits against those about those sorts of issues. And even if you're not covered by an arbitration contract now, let me tell you, it's coming. Your employer will start producing these sort of arbitration contracts left, right, and center, no matter what type of work you're involved in. And so with that case and with the Janus case, this will be one of the most remarkable courts, remarkable anti-worker courts in U.S. history. So on that happy note, I will stop.
You're listening to a panel discussion on the plot to defund public sector unions regarding the case of Janus versus AFSCME. The Supreme Court handed down its decision 5-4 on June 27, 2018. The decision dealt a major blow to organized labor. The three panelists are Cortland Roser-Jones with the UW Law School, Mary Batari, Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and Kevin Gunlag, President of the South Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO.
My name is Kevin Gunlag, President of South Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. I think I'll start with a little bit about my story, and I think it'll be relevant. So I did not grow up in a union till I was in like 28 or 30-some years old. I had no idea what unions were. I worked in a factory where people were killed and died. They were shooting out pollutants into the community. We didn't know we could make a difference. We just figured we'll fight alone, and that's what we did. We fought alone. I worked in a facility here in Madison where workers were being retaliated against due to their race, due to their ethnicity, due to their gender, and due to their sexual orientation. And I was being told everything by the brother who was hired under a false name by the executive director. And every time someone complained to him or complained to her, she'd fire them or try to get rid of them. And we then fought back, and we won. I was the only one fighting, actually. A law firm finally picked it up. No one was going to pick it up. And that's how I got my first union job, because I started applying for jobs, and I got a county job. Part-time, 16 hours a week, weekends only, nights. The woman I was seeing was not thrilled with it, but she was also happy that I got a job. And that's when someone approached me and said, you know, I read about you. It was in the news with our battle. Read about you. You won the case. You know, you want to be a part of the union. Obviously, I was going to be a part of the union, but she was asking, did I want to become active? And I said, well, sure. What does that mean? She goes, well, you know, she explained. I said, so we have each other's back. She said, that's right. I said that I'm in. I don't have to fight alone anymore. And I think the Labor Council runs the same way. Unions have each other's back. I think what we work on, it's about democracy, it's about transparency, it's about accountability. And that's really what our governmental system is supposed to be about. And that is a threat to those who want power and wealth. And it's never, ever enough. So working for government and in a union, we were able to sit on safety committees for the workers so that we could have input and save life and limb, unlike what I had at that other company. We were able to find efficiencies in government as workers and save taxpayer dollars in this county on one issue alone, $9 to $11 million for 1 year alone. And that was through a committee that we had bargained for. I could go on. They were finding efficiencies, they were saving taxpayer dollars, they were saving lives. We also had a committee for the public, a public safety committee, with highway workers, with all the unions sitting there at the table, with some management as well. So we had labor management committees. When we talk about Act 10, which was the first attack, the first major attack that I think got a lot of workers involved in their unions here in Wisconsin, all those rights were taken away. Then they go after right to work for the private sector, and that they thought would mainly affect our manufacturing and factory workers and service sector workers. Then that wasn't enough. They had to go after what's called project labor agreements and prevailing wage, which they thought would negatively impact the building trades. Then they went after labor peace agreements, which was going to negatively impact non-union members and the service sector unions primarily. And then we have the most recent attacks, which you brought up, EPIC, with the wage theft issue, which is primarily directed towards non-union workers, and let alone the three federal executive orders that go after federal government employees when it comes to using union time for grievances and working on behalf of the workers, as well as now they can fire all the workers a lot easier and quicker, among other things that those did. So the Janus case, interesting enough, I'm not hearing a lot from the local unions here because they've already been attacked nonstop, month after month, with their working conditions and everything else. So what they're focusing on is internal organizing and creative ways to externally organize. So in other words, organize the workplace where you're at, where you're already union, and then externally organize, which is organizing new workers into unions in a creative way. Because each time they try to do something, we're thinking, where are the Republicans going to come with a new law? And I can give you an example for Fight for 15. It was Fight for 15 and a union. And Milwaukee passes an ordinance, and the state passes something against them so that we can't do it. We had workers all over this city and other cities in Wisconsin that were doing strikes. Labor took the step forward to organize with clergy, with elected officials, with the community to walk those workers back in. So we had a plan there. So with the Janus case, I think the way the unions are looking at it as how it's going to impact Wisconsin is we've already been hit legally. So that means they're going after the other states, the Northeast, the Northwest. The state with the highest union density is New York, over 20%. The only other state that's over 20% is Hawaii. So then you've got the Northwest states and the Northeastern states. What states have the most progressive legislation? The Northeast, the Northwest, Hawaii, New York, California. What are the states with the lowest union density? It's right now South Carolina. It has been for a while. It's up to 2.5% because they went up a little bit since they just organized some workers in a really hostile terrain against unions. Which leads, so what this is going to do is Janus is going to impact these other states, which means less resources go to the international unions from those states, which means less resources from the international unions come to states like Wisconsin, which have been hit recently, as well as the states like South Carolina. So in other words, as some union people like to tell me when we're talking over lunch or whatnot, we're kind of on our own, which doesn't mean we're not on our own in terms of the community and so forth, but there's going to be less resources for unions here, which means we have to be even more creative. So some of the things that we're working on and have been doing, I got elected right after Act 10. I'll talk about the electoral program real quickly. The first thing we did was we said we're not going to just play politics, the unions, which we had been for spring elections, in just Madison and Dane County. So we moved outside of Madison and Dane County. We had to convince some of the folks who are traditionalists, and they said, we'll give it a try. And since then, with our community partners, many other people getting involved, obviously, many people probably here too, we have a 90% win rate overall in 11 counties. And some of those counties, we have over 50%, some 70, 80% in counties that are conservative. So with our messaging, with how we talk to people, not just at the doors, but in terms of organizing efforts, I think we're making a difference there, building a bench, slowly winning over some county boards. We just won over the Sauk County Board for the first time ever to have some pro-labor candidates and union members running for office. And we did the same thing with Jefferson County, and we're going to be going after certain other counties later. As far as non-electoral efforts, with the less resources coming from Wisconsin, we have something called the Solidarity Support Network through the South Central Federation of Labor that is there to assist unions when it comes to organizing efforts, when it comes to difficult bargaining campaigns on the private sector side, when it comes to having discussions with our elected officials and having a plan set in place. So it's a long-term plan sitting down with these unions. So they're not just thinking in a reactionary mode, or they're not just thinking, well, if we can only win on the election side, which, you know, will take some time, and that is part of the plan, but we have to be doing something else besides that. They're investing the manufacturing unions that have been affected by right to work in the private sector. They have, and mind you, when I'm talking about these different unions, they're talking to each other, so this is going to affect the unions that would be, you know, this will be also talking, we've also sent unions talking to other states, including Minnesota, Illinois, so that they can find out what has been successful for our unions here, so that when Janus hits, they might try some of those things, which they already are. So internal organizing efforts have been from day one, they're investing a lot of time in that. More communication with their members, setting up some creative ways to talk about dues and so forth, and also mapping the workplaces and so forth. They're also starting young worker programs within the unions. Some of the, and this is for all of them, the manufacturing side, they've got something called Triada. So that's a temp agency, that's union, that works with that underbids the for-profit, and it's a nonprofit, and that way these factories that were being threatened to be, that the factory owners would say, we're leaving if you don't give us more temp workers, this prevents that. And those workers then become full-time within 6 months, 3 months. So it was something a little creative. There's something called WRTP Big Step with the building trades. That's working with all the different nonprofit organizations so that we can have more diversity in the building trades. Bring more people of color and women into the trades. And mind you, our biggest service sector union and our biggest manufacturing factory worker union, both of those are about 40 to 60, it fluctuates, 40 to 60% non-white male. So they're already successful reaching out to other communities that have been neglected in the past by labor. Also, for the public sector side, our local, the one that I come out of, which is 90% women and about 70% people of color and recent arrivals from every continent except Antarctica. And we set up a lot of support systems. I'm really proud that since I've left that the union members that have taken on the mantle there, this is where they're under Act 10. They don't get to bargain over anything, nothing. They are at 97 or 98% sign up rate. So just a handful of workers have not signed up and believed in their union. So in Dane County, in the city of Madison, in the school district here, there's actually some success with the public sector in those specific areas. I can't say the same thing with some of the state workers, can't say the same thing with some of the university workers, they've been hit hard. So I think, Janus, if we get rid of Act 10, I hate to say this, and I said it earlier, for the workers that are affected by Act 10, Janus is actually an improvement. So that's how bad it is here in Wisconsin for the public sector workers. So when they do talk to workers in other states about what they're going to face with Janus, they can say, look, we've got A, B, C, and D. You've got A and B that you're dealing with. Let's sit down and talk and let's compare notes. And I think that's been helpful. The unions have actually found that very helpful from some of the from Minnesota, Illinois, and so forth. The National AFL-CIO is dedicating a lot more efforts into organizing. Another thing that we're doing, because see, the thing is, we have to increase union density, whether that's in the public sector side or the private sector side. So while we're trying to internally organize and protect on the public sector side, which is what we've invested a lot of time and effort in, we still have to, what I call, go on offense on the private sector side. So those unions are doing quite well, even though they've been attacked one time after another. One of the really creative models that we just started working with that I think is going to get going more so in a year, we've already had some successes, are unionized worker-owned co-ops, and we're working with the city of Madison on that, and that we've already, I think, have two new co-ops that are union, that are worker-owned. And that's been more, that, I think, call that one of our more creative projects. And I think by having success at the in the city of Madison, we'll be able to go to some foundations and go to Dane County and others so they can invest in that too. The other thing that we're doing, we've reached out and continue to reach out, but I think we've amped it up a level, reaching out to our partners in the LGBTQ community, dealing with civil rights issues, women's rights issues, environmental organizations. I even reached out to Sierra Club and other organizations that typically labor doesn't really work with, and they invited me to go to D.C. to fight on an issue that was that I think we could all agree on. And so sometimes I think when you hear from someone, whether they're in the labor movement or not, and they say, ooh, don't try that, you might upset, you know, some other people in the labor movement or someone else, I'll say, well, then let's try it once and I can feign ignorance. Or I'll try it twice and then I'll feign ignorance. But and a lot of those things that we've tried, and it is a we effort, have been successful, and we're just going to keep trying different different methods and try different tactics and until we, well, we're going to have to continue to do this because I don't see anything happening in any year soon to favor labor when it comes to legislation. Hopefully we'll change things in the next 6 to 8 years, but and even when things change, I think we need to really have a plan to organize new workers into unions and put in much time and effort into that as we do our electoral. Not taking away anything from the electoral, but we really have to focus on that as well. And I'll leave it at that, I guess. Thanks.
I think us as a panel, are we in agreement that we think it'll come down 5-4? Or are we not sure we want to say it? I've thought for some time it is probably going to be 5-4 in favor of Bark Janice. So I'll put my name on that. I think there's some debate on who will write the decision. And I always thought that Justice Alito would want this one so bad because he's written two other cases before that have mentioned Abood and how much he dislikes it. But now we're thinking it might go to the Chief Justice or maybe Justice Kennedy. I think you should look for a very strong dissent from Justice Kagan. I hope she writes another one. If you have extra time and you're interested in this, I highly recommend her dissent from Harris v. Quinn. It's readable, but also incredibly animated, and she is also a very animated speaker. And during the argument, I mean, she had this great moment that you don't get to hear very often. It was more contested than most Supreme Court arguments are, just because 8 of the justices have already heard this, right? So it's not a lot of times during oral argument, a lot of it is done to educate the justices on a very specific, minor, highly technical legal issue. There are 8 of them are experts on this, right? We just heard it 2 years ago. So it was very much contested, and she had a great moment. She just looked at the lawyers for Mark Janice and said, look, I don't think we've ever overturned a case where the reliance issues have been more important and more significant than we have in this case, which is, you know, and she's talking about not just her or not just these 9 justices, but we're going back to the court. I mean, we're looking at the court as a whole, perhaps overturning something that has more of a reliance influence than any other case that we've ever overturned. So I think she will write a very good dissent, and lengthy and passionate. We are all watching Justice Kennedy because we tend to be when it's a close and contested case, and he tends to be our swing vote. My professor gut is that I didn't think he gave me any indicator that he was going to swing on this. Justice Kennedy is a swing vote, and usually you can get him, or usually the liberal justices can will cater to him, but he's also a free speech champion, right? You know, he has signaled to us that he's probably got a year, maybe two left. That's why we had so many free speech cases in this term, I think, is that he's really looking to solidify his legacy as a free speech scholar and as you know, moving free speech into what he views it. And he gave me no indication at all that he was willing to side with the liberal justices. He had a moment that was just like, if you're watching, and that he was, you know, he asked the, his name was Friedrichs too, the attorney who was, or the solicitor general was talking, and he said basically, so unions, if I take away this, you know, these fair share fees, they'll have less political power, right? And he said, well, yes. Well, isn't that the end of it? And then he didn't say it, that was, he was done. So, it, you know, he had nothing else to say, and we didn't, he didn't give us any other clues. The only other thing we were watching pretty closely was Justice Gorsuch, because he was not the justice who was on the court when we heard it 2 years ago. A lot of us were watching him very closely. In fact, there got to some moments where you felt like the lawyers were talking straight at him. he gave us nothing. Justice Gorsuch is not known for not saying anything during oral argument. In fact, he loves to talk during oral argument. And he said nothing. So we have no tips whatsoever about where he'll go. But there's nothing in his past, you know, judicial history that would make me think we could get him. But he did give us nothing, and it was really interesting to watch. I think if he would have sneezed, half of the audience would have fallen off their chair, and he just nothing. So that's where we're at. We'll see. I will say, just Mary, because I'm up here, because I wanted to tell you this story, and I found your article so wonderful. But when you're talking about this being the most depressing article, or one of the most depressing articles you've written, I will agree with you that one of the most demoralizing moments I've ever had, and I've been writing about the labor movement for a while, was when I got there pretty early for the argument, because I was on a short list, but I didn't know how many people they put on that list. So I was there at about 4 a.m. I was very proud of that. I'm not a morning person, so I just stayed up. 4:15 a.m. And it could have been out of a movie. 5 white vans pull up and drop off these giant boxes from Kinko's. And I'm like, oh, wow, what's going to come out of those boxes? And it was T-shirts. It was signed Stand With Mark. I'm actually going to send you a Stand With Mark, because they just gave them to me, because there were so many people, they didn't care. And I think I've never been more demoralized, because I was like, I just looked around and I just said, they're not only well-funded, they get up early. And they get up really early. And by the time I went in, they had quite a few people, but not as many as that were there to protest the union on the other side, but they had like an AV system set up, so they sounded really loud. And I'm not talking they just had signs. They had like the poster board signs that are cork boards with like the full sticks that cost $12 a piece, because I've made those for my classes before. And the unions have like the homemade signs. And I was glad that I had read your article before, because it just hit me right in the face when I saw it. That 20 people sound a lot louder when you give them microphones, when you can pay, you know, to have a sound system there. But it was very much, you know, they had T-shirts, they had hats.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on the plot to defund public sector unions regarding the case of Janus versus AFSCME. The Supreme Court justices handed down a decision of 5-4, on that case on June 27, 2018. The decision dealt a major blow to organized labor. Those in the majority said that forcing those workers to finance union activity violated the First Amendment. The three panelists were Cortland Roser Jones, the William Hastie Fellow at UW-Madison Law School, Mary Batari, Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and Kevin Gunlach, President of the South Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. The talk took place on June 13, 2018, at the Madison Central Library, and was sponsored by the Madison Institute, the Center for Media and Democracy, South Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, and the American Constitution Society. For more thought-provoking programs by the Madison Institute, go to their website at themadisoninstitute.org.